You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 2003, Gary Carter received the highest honor in baseball when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in honor of a 19-year career in which he became one of the best catchers ever to play the game. And although he was a multiple Gold Glove winner and a perennial All-Star, he's probably best remembered, in this town anyway, for his role in the Mets' 1986 World Series victory. He recounts his experiences on the field and off in Still a Kid at Heart, My Life in Baseball and Beyond. It is published by Triumph Books, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Gary Carter to the show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Very nice to be here. It's a pleasure. And what a nice introduction.
You write that you never planned on being a Major League Baseball player. What did you think you'd become?
Football player, actually. When I was growing up in Southern California, I did play all the three major sports. I started out playing basketball. In fact, I was in the first grade playing for the third grade team at the Boys Club, Fullerton Boys Club. And then I always, you know, loved baseball. I started out in Little League at age 8 and played it all the way up till you could not play it any longer at age 12, and then I went into Pony League and then eventually into American Legion ball. But I really fell in love with football when I got to high school. I was a punt, pass, and kick champion back when I was 7 years of age, the very first year of its existence. Ford Motor Company sponsored it. And as a seven-year-old kid, Leonard, I won the national championship and then went back again at age 9, but unfortunately slipped on the frozen turf and the ball slipped out of my hands. It was at Wrigley Field. It was 25 below when the Bears played the Giants in the championship game. And it wasn't really until I got to high school, though, that I really got the full enjoyment of what the game of football is all about.
And you were considered one of the top high school quarterbacks in the country. But when you were offered a scholarship to play college football at UCLA, you were also drafted by the Montreal Expos in the third round, not the first round.
Right.
And yet you chose to go into baseball.
Well, the primary reason was I had torn the ligaments in my right knee, missing my whole senior year, and my real only ticket to college was through a scholarship. And my father was in the aviation industry, and he was a procurement coordinator, was with Hughes Aircraft, McDonnell Douglas, Rockwell, to name a few of the aviation industries. And he really couldn't afford. My brother was in the same boat. My brother was drafted number in the second round by the California Angels back then in 1968, turned it down. Why? Because, well, the Vietnam War was going on. He had a very low draft number, and he went to college, and he went to USC on a full Cardinal and Gold scholarship. I was basically following in his footsteps in every capacity. And, Leonard, I made the decision that I thought that education was extremely important. So I basically decided that, okay, the knee was healthy enough that I could pursue my football career. But also UCLA was the only school out of all the scholarship offers that were going to allow me to play both sports. So I signed with them, but then 5 days later I was drafted. And then an orthopedic surgeon by the name of Robert Curlin, who was the Lakers and Rams orthopedists team doctor, he examined my knee and he says, "Well, son, I must say that if you were mine, I would advise you to go into baseball." But I never thought, Leonard, that I would become a catcher because that's more wear and tear on the knees.
That was the irony of it. What position were you playing at the time?
I was a shortstop, pitcher, and then probably my junior and senior years when I got recognized a little bit, I was playing third base and first base. But there was a scout that came around at the time by the name of Bob Zuck with Montreal. And he said to me, "Have you ever caught?" And I said, "Well, no, not really. I, you know, indulged a little bit in Little League just to give it an experimental try." And so I said, "Okay, I'll give it a shot." And he goes, "Well, it is the quickest way to the big leagues, you know." And I said, "Well, if that's the way it is, then I'll give it a shot."
But I'd also imagine that because of your experience as a quarterback, you probably had the right kind of sensibility for being a catcher, because they're the two people who have the most control over the game while they're in it.
Well, you're exactly right with that, because that's exactly what he acknowledged and recognized as well, was the leadership qualities. You know, being a quarterback, you are the quarterback on the field as a catcher. You're basically calling the game, handling the game. You're in on every play. And I love that aspect of it. In fact, the thing I miss the most, Leonard, of my playing days would have to be calling a game.
And what does it mean when a catcher calls a great game? Because a pitcher often shakes off what the catcher is suggesting.
Right.
Is that part of calling a great game?
I think so. I mean, it's not a part for all the shakeoffs, because I think that it's important for a pitcher to not get into a routine or any kind of a rhythm per se without ever acknowledging a shakeoff or change a location or something like that. It's a mind game. And the thing that I loved about it is that I used to really study the hitters, all of their idiosyncrasies when they were in the batter's box, and if they got two strikes, did they go up on the bat? Did they move up in the box? How did they approach certain, or were they a first ball fastball hitter? All those kind of things. And I must say, Leonard, that part of the game is kind of a lost art, because I don't think that catchers really study the game quite to the same extent. I took a lot of pride in my pitching staff having the lowest ERA in the league. And I think with today, with all these scouting reports and everything so computerized and everything, really catchers don't have to think that much out there anymore.
But I'm sure a pitcher's tendency is to try to come in with what he thinks is his best pitch. And it's your job to out-psychologize the batter and say, well, everybody knows that he's going to throw a fastball here on the outside corner. Let's throw a curveball right on the inside corner.
Well, that's the mind game, and that's the game within the game. And you're absolutely right on target with that, Leonard, because that's the wonderful thing about the great game of baseball, is that it's something new that occurs every day. Something is going to pop up that you've probably never seen before, and that's what's so exciting about the game.
But, you chose to play baseball rather than football. Many people have, because of the longevity factor. You
right.
can play baseball a lot longer, because football, if you get beat up, and people often do, and they get concussions,
right.
you can have, I think the average is a 3-year career.
Correct.
You had a particularly long career, but in the position that it's hardest to maintain longevity.
Well, fortunately, I was blessed with a pretty strong body to the extent. I mean, I went 12 years in between knee surgeries, but I've now had 11 total, and I've had my right knee totally replaced. So it eventually, no pun intended, caught up with me. So I must say, Leonard, that it's a part of the game, all of the ups and downs and the wear and tear, and obviously most of it was cartilage. But I think it was all the beginning stages of it was from that knee injury from football.
Do you still creak when you bend down to pick up?
Yes. In fact, I have to go in and oil up my knee every now and then. You know, I've got an oil can like the Tin Man of the Wizard of Oz to lube up every now and then. But no, I for the most part, at 54 years old now, Leonard, I feel very blessed. And to play 18 years behind the plate and have caught over 2,000 games in the major leagues, it's something that I'm very, very proud of.
My guest is Gary Carter, who's written with Phil, is it Pepe?
Yep, Phil Pepe.
Still a Kid at Heart, My Life in Baseball and Beyond, published by Triumph. How did you get the nickname Kid?
That came in my very first big league spring training camp, and I was just a young, raw 18-year-old kid with that was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed when I came into camp. And, I mean, it was like a dream come true. I mean,
played in the minors already?
I had played one half season, Leonard. That was it. I signed in 1972. I went to the Gulf Coast League, which was a rookie league. At the end, about a month into that season, I was called up to West Palm Beach, which ironically now is my home residence, and played 1 month in the Florida State League, and then went to Instructional League, and then was invited to Big League Camp. And so here I am at Big League Camp, just an excited young kid, just to be there and trying to win all the races when it came to sprint time. Tried to take more batting practice. I always kept saying, one more, Leonard, one more, you know. And then finally I was invited to a card game at the Americana Hotel, in which was our kind of home hotel basis. And there were several guys, Ken Singleton, Mike Torres, Tim Foley, you know, the elder statesman, per se, on the team. And here I was invited to this card game. Wasn't allowed to play, but I got a chance to rub shoulders with the veteran guys. Now, veteran guys back then were treated like royalty. I mean, it was like if they spoke to you, you could maybe answer back. If you, they didn't say anything to you, you didn't speak. So anyway, Mike Torres one time, you know, in between hands or whatever, says, he looks at me and he goes, "Hey, kid, why don't you go get us some ice cream?" And I go, "Okay." And I ran downstairs, took the elevator, ran across the street to 31 Flavors and brought them all back ice cream. And, of course, I had to pay for it, too. That was part of the initiation. But you know what? It was just a great experience. And because of my, I guess, over-infectious enthusiasm and everything, Leonard, that's when the nickname stuck.
Is that respect for veterans gone in this age of huge
salaries? I think it is,
yeah.
I definitely think it is. I think that with what players have today in regard to the salaries, and most players when they sign out of high school or college, if they're high draft picks, we're talking about multi-year deals that they're signing. You know, anywhere from $5 to $10 million if you're a top first or second round pick. And by the time they get to the big leagues, they're groomed enough and they've been given enough candy, per se, that, you know, they feel that they're owed that. So when they get to the big leagues, if you're a veteran, you know, evidence of, I think, and I'm sure you probably know a little bit of the background of a guy like Lasting's Millage, mm-hmm. when he came to the big leagues and with the Mets. High profile guy, talked about high, you know, number one pick, all this and that. And he comes up here and he's strutting his stuff. And, well, the veteran guys tried to put him in his place. And I don't think he was really in tune to that the way he should have been.
And now he's playing with the Nationals.
Exactly.
When you signed a long term deal with the Expos, the highest paid player in baseball was Dave Winfield at $23 million over
right.
10 years. That number would be considered like almost marginal player today.
Well, exactly, especially since the minimum salary now, if you take everyone into account, and of course we know the highest paid in today's game is Alex Rodriguez of the Yankees, making $25 or $26 million a year, and it might even exceed that to get up to around $28 million. But it's over $3 million a year for the average salary. Back when I first started, Leonard, in my rookie season, minimum salary was $16,000.
My guest is Gary Carter, who has written, with the help of Philip Pepe, "Still a Kid at Heart: My Life in Baseball and Beyond," published by Triumph, with a foreword by a very, very great catcher, Johnny Bench. I guess it takes one to know one. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Gary Carter, who has written a book called "Still a Kid at Heart: My Life in Baseball and Beyond," published by Triumph Books, written with the help of veteran sports writer Phil Pepe. You signed with the Expos as a third baseman, first baseman.
Well, yes, but they theoretically listed me as a catcher.
So that's not something you just learn just like that. How long before you kind of you figured it out?
Well, Leonard, when I went to the first camp, which was in Jamestown, New York, there were several catchers there. One of them in particular that I definitely remember and who stands out is Michel Dion, who ended up becoming the Pittsburgh Penguins goaltender, mm-hmm. and a kid from the Montreal area, and a very good receiver, not much of a hitter. There was other guys there, too. The number one pick that year was a kid out of Memphis, Tennessee, by the name of Bobby Goodman. And I'm watching these guys and their abilities and their mechanics and their fundamentals and everything, and I was probably the worst catcher there because I didn't know all of those styles or techniques. And I had good coaching. I'll never forget Bill McKenzie, who was very instrumental in working with me. He was a guy that was a Canadian-born guy and was in the Detroit Tigers organization for a number of years. But he was very instrumental in helping me along and trying to learn the position. And it just took time and experience and going and playing nearly every day because I played two instructional league seasons and two winter ball seasons. So I was playing nearly what, 275 games maybe in the course exhausted. Of the year. Well, it was, but when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you don't even think about that, Leonard.
Do you think you had an advantage of having been a quarterback because you had a strong arm? Although I've heard that they usually don't like quarterbacks because they throw the ball differently than other players.
That's exactly right, because I was rated when I signed having a D arm. When you go through the alphabet A through F, I had a D arm, Leonard, and as time went on, and fortunately I can say very proudly that I won 3 gold gloves. I felt like I could have maybe possibly won a couple of more, but there was also another catcher who happened to write the forward that happened to be in the prime of his career too. So
what happens when you see somebody like Johnny Bench and you know you're great,
right?
Because you're having a wonderful career. The statistics don't lie. And yet you know that Johnny Bench may be the best that ever lived.
Well, when I broke into the league in 1975 full-time, you know, you look at a guy like Johnny Bench, who in 1970 and 1972 was the MVP of the league. 1968, which I mentioned first, was that he was Rookie of the Year. In that short span, he is being now touted as the greatest catcher of all time. And he also developed the one-handed style of catching, where he protected his throwing hand and put it behind his back. And I emulated that, and I really caught on to that, because I used to study all the other catchers around the league and everything, Leonard, and I really tried to develop my own style. But I went to my first All-Star game at my rookie season in Milwaukee in 1975, and Johnny befriended me, and we've been friends ever since. And one of the reasons why I asked him if he would be so kind to write the foreword, and had nothing but great things to say. But nevertheless, if there was one guy you wanted to try to be compared to and try to be like, it was Johnny Bench.
Were there people using steroids in those days, do you think?
Not of my knowledge. When it became more prominent, I think it became at the time when I retired from the game in 92. I went to my first All-Star game in 93 as a broadcaster when I was broadcasting for the Marlins. And I had the pleasure of going down on the field and watching the home run hitting contest, which has become a major popular event at the All-Star game. And I'm looking at guys like Brady Anderson, Leonard, and I don't know if you remember that miraculous year he had where he hit 50 home runs. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at this guy and I'm going, good Lord, either he's been a gym rat and has got veins on top of veins, or he's doing something out of the ordinary. And then more and more guys you were hearing about, and then the
McGuire
home run total.
And Sosa.
Yeah, well, sure. In 1998, when Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire had that home run chase, it brought the fans back. We all know about what happened in 1994 when the strike occurred and the rest of the season was canceled and there was no World Series that year. Something had to be done to bring the fans back. And I think that the steroid issue became a big thing, and I think the owners were aware of it too, Leonard, but kind of turned the cheek on it. But here's the other thing too, is that the ball became livelier. There was a number of things that occurred to bring the fans back, but it was ultimately the home run chase between Sosa and McGuire that brought them back.
Now, you had a great final season with the Expos. You hit a league-leading 106 RBIs, which is good, especially for a catcher. Because catchers don't always play every day in the way that some other position players do.
Right.
And then they traded you to the Mets. Now, they had already caused a stir in Montreal when they traded Rusty Staub to the Mets.
Sure.
Then they traded you, and I'm sure that there were practically riots in the street there. But what about coming to New York? A lot of players don't like playing here. How did you feel about being traded?
Well, I thought it was like a breath of fresh air, because obviously in Montreal, and being that I played my first 10 years there and my last year being in 84 before I returned back and finished my career back in Montreal in 92. But when I came to New York, it was like, oh my goodness. And I'll never forget my opening day against the St. Louis Cardinals. Joaquin Andujar was the starting pitcher. And I think it was in my first at bat that he proceeded to throw me one of those sinking fastballs on a very cold, blustery day. at Shea Stadium, and probably somewhere, if it would have been the middle of the season, I may not have played because it swelled up like crazy and it was so cold. I could have just stuck my arm out in the air, and that's how cold it was, instead of putting ice on it. But I did, and I stayed in the game, and unfortunately, I was able to hit a walk-off home run, as they call him now, off of Neil Allen in the bottom of the 10th inning. And I was received by the fans so glamorously that, I mean, it was just so exhilarating, Leonard, because in Montreal, they're more gentleman-like in their acknowledging greatness on the field. I remember hitting three home runs in a game one time, and I got kind of a round of applause. But here, after hitting a walk-off home run, they were chanting my name as they were walking out the turnstile.
They wanted you to come out for curtain calls.
For the encore, yeah. And I mean, that became a big deal during my five-year tenure with the Mets as well.
So why do you think so many players are unhappy about
playing in New York? I think it's because it's too much pressure. I think it's there's guys, we can bring up names like Ed Whitson and Steve Sachs and Chuck Knobloch and other names, but you know, those that come to mind right away. And it's a lot of that there's a lot of pressure, a lot of expectation.
Yeah, but the players complain that they get booed when they go into a slump, but they get booed in Philadelphia as well.
Absolutely, but it's a part of the game. I think if you get booed in Philadelphia, now of course I know Mike Schmidt in particular, great player, was booed many a times in Philadelphia, but Schmidt was a different player. He was so serious all the time. And I think where fans have the right to be able to boo Leonard, I think a lot of it has to do with how a player's persona is and what his body language is like. If he's given it a full-out effort every day, running the bases hard, playing, you know, hustling all the time, then fans will acknowledge that. If you go 0-for-4, I remember the fans booed Derek Jeter when he got off to a very slow start that one year. And here's the team captain and a great player and probably a Hall of Famer. But nevertheless,
I don't think they're going to boo him anymore. Or David Wright, for that matter.
Exactly.
Gary Carter is my guest. His book, Still a Kid at Heart, My Life in Baseball and Beyond. Much has been made of the rowdiness of those the 1986 Mets.
Right.
In fact, there was a book, The Bad Guys Won. How did you fit into that whole dynamic? Because you definitely were one of the good guys.
Well, I hate for something like that to have come out, but we did have a cast of characters from that 86 team.
And were people aware, and were players aware of the off-the-field behavior of Dwight Gooden, Daryl Strawberry, and some of the other troubled players on the team?
I certainly wasn't, Leonard. I mean, I was very naive to it all when I found out about it later. In fact, you know, I mentioned in the book as well about that grim day on April 1st of 1987, after our successes that we had, especially in 86 of winning the World Series, when Frank Cashin walked into the clubhouse and told us that Dwight Gooden was caught with drugs in his system and was going to be sent off to Smithers back here in New York for rehabilitation. And it just was a sad day for that to hear that, because I had no clue that, you know, Doc was doing anything like that, or even Daryl for that matter. But, you know, it is a matter of choices we all have. And I just was so caught up in wanting to just play the game that I never really got involved in what happened with extracurricular stuff off the field. So I don't know. I hate to be looked at as really one of the good guys, because we were a cast of characters.
But every team has its mix, the straight arrows and the bad guys.
Right.
And I've always been amazed that 25 can travel around together and get along, considering the fact that I know that there are people who just rub me the wrong way.
Right. Well, the biggest thing is, and this is, I think, goes without saying in all aspects of sports, what people do off the playing surface, whether it be on the court or on the football field or hockey rink or baseball field, I think what it really comes down to accept oneself and everything, is how they perform on that field. And what they do off the field is entirely their business, so I don't think that should really enter into it.
Well, you played in one of the most exciting World Series that is possible, the 86 series. First of all, the Mets lost the first two games to the Red Sox, and up to that point, only one team had come back from that
to win the World Series. I don't know whether players even think about that sort of thing.
Oh, it was brought to our attention. The media wouldn't let us not think about it. But, you know, I mentioned in my book, and in fact, what's so exciting about it is that I kind of start off the book explaining the excitement of the 86 series. And, of course, we all know about what transpired in Game 6 and then going on and winning Game 7. But the fact of the matter is that we had that hard-fought series against the Houston Astros, and we were exhausted after that series. I mean, that sixth and final game where we came back from a 3-0 deficit in the top of the ninth inning and then went 16 innings, and the game lasted well over 5 hours. I think it was like 5 hours and 42 minutes. It was just one of those things that when we lost the first two games, we still had hope because that's the way we were all season long.
Although you did rather well in a couple of the games. Game 4, you hit two homers over the Green Monster.
Right.
Maybe we can listen to a little bit of Vin Scully's TV call of Game 6.
I look forward to it.
Can you believe this ball game at Shea?
Oh, brother. Woo.
So the winning run is at second base with two out, 3-2 to Mookie Wilson. Little roller up along first, behind the bag. It gets through Buckner. Here comes Knight, and the Mets win it. If one picture is worth a thousand words, you have seen about a million words. But more than that, you have seen an absolutely bizarre finish to Game 6 of the 1986 World Series. The Mets are not only alive, they are well, and they will play the Red Sox in Game 7 tomorrow.
Huh. And they did, and they won. But people don't remember that you began the rally that Mookie wound up being safe on with a single to left, and that was against Cal Schiraldi.
Yeah.
Were there mind games?
Little bit, but I must say that I had the pleasure, I guess, of saying that I caught Calvin Schiraldi when he got called up at the end of the 1985 season, and I got a little bit of an idea of what his personality was like. And, of course, he was involved in the trade that brought us Bobby Ojeda, who ended up winning 18 ball games for us that year in 86. And so when I came up to the plate, first thing that came to my mind, first of all, that God was going to bless me with the ability to come through in some capacity.
But I'm sure you came up other times and you grounded out.
But I didn't want to be a trivia question either, Leonard. Who made the last out of the 86 World Series? That distinction goes to Marty Barrett when Jesse Orosco struck him out in Game 7. But nevertheless, I came up there with just a lot of confidence, and I really felt like one way or another I was going to get on base to get something going. And Kevin Mitchell, who was in the clubhouse, ironically, trying to plan for a flight to get out of there for the next day, was called, and he runs out there and he scurries around and puts himself together. Then he gets the hit. Then, of course, Ray Knight had a hard-fought at bat and hit that bloop over Marty Barrett's head that sent me home and Kevin Mitchell to third. Then John McLemore might have made the biggest mistake of the night when he brought in Bob Stanley, who had been a longtime reliever. They call him the steamer. And then he didn't make the change at first base where he used to always bring in Dave Stapleton for defensive purposes. And it turns out that it backfired on him because he felt like Bill Buckner was due his time on the field if the Red Sox were going to win.
What happened when you decided to leave the game? You were back with the Expos. Was it difficult to do? Or did you just say, look, I can't hit the... I'm just swinging too late. There's nothing I can do about it.
No, it really boiled down to the joy of the game had left, and the fun part had also left. But more importantly, my body was so broken down at that time, Leonard, that my recovery time took so much longer. I'd catch a game and it would take me almost the entire day getting back to the ballpark to even prepare myself to be able to play. And I missed a lot of pitches that I should have hit hard that I remembered that I was able to earlier in my career. And it just comes a point in time, and at age 38, I realized that, God intended it for me to leave the game as a player. but not as someone that was going to leave the game entirely. So in the book, it talks about what's transpired since then, broadcasting for 7 years with the Marlins and with the Expos, and then got into the coaching and managing ranks.
For the Mets, St. Lucie team.
Exactly. Won that championship for them in 2006.
But then after you did that, you were offered a move up, and players all want to move up. You retired instead.
Well, I didn't really retire. I chose not to go to Binghamton. And Leonard, have you been to Binghamton, New York before?
I know you live in Florida and you want
yes.
to stay there.
Well, I would have liked to have preferred to have stayed at least close to home if I had to be in the minor leagues. And I didn't see the reason for moving up, primarily because I asked for one thing. Well, give me a reason, and also what is my future expectations and hopes in this regard? And if they would have given that to me, I probably would have gone.
Well, we have seen any number of catchers become really good managers. It's because they're thinking the way they thought when they were in the game?
33% of the major league managers last year happened to be ex-catchers. So, yes, because you have the whole perspective and everything right in front of you. And so primarily, yes, and you, it's a thinking man's game. And so being behind the plate, not only calling the games, but you also have a pretty good idea about the pitchers and the pitching staff as a whole.
Now, you waited 6 years on the ballot before yes. you were finally chosen for the Hall of Fame. Were you starting to despair that you might never make it?
A little, but I think it was just eventually because of where my vote total was going to. The first year was a respectable 200 votes, but then the next year when Nolan Ryan, Robin Yount, and George Brett were on the ballot, I lost 32 votes, and I didn't understand the process. But then I recaptured those votes the next year. Carlton Fisk was on the ballot for the first time, and that may have helped me because, obviously, Carlton got into the Hall of Fame the second year, and then my vote total kept going up. But after the fifth year, I missed out by 11 votes, and then people that were acknowledging that were saying that it's only a matter of time, and sure enough, it did happen the next year.
And you went in as a Met or an Expo?
They put me in as an Expo. I was the first guinea pig, Leonard, that didn't have the choice of choosing the teams, and my argument with that, with Dale Petroski, the then president of the Hall of Fame, is that I simply said it looks as though that either the Expos are going to be contracted or moved, and eventually that's exactly what happened. And I said, how or why should I be remembered for a player and will be the one and only Expo in the Hall of Fame? Because 25 years up the road, people are going to say, the Montreal Expos? Who? You know? And I just simply said, Dale, for argument reasons, I says I had some very good success in New York. I'm a part of the organization. I was a coach and manager for 6 years with the organization until I decided not to go to AA. And for reasons, because of not wanting to go on long bus rides and things like that because of my knees. And I played in that league when I was a 19-year-old kid, and it's a AA league, and I figured it wouldn't have mattered. But the Mets were not receptive to that change. But I'm hoping something, Leonard, will happen in the future because I'm going to be managing an independent league team out in California this summer.
Meanwhile, the picture of you on the cover of this book is in a Mets uniform.
Yes.
And it's of Gary Carter, who is written with the help of Phil Pepe, Still a Kid at Heart, My Life in Baseball and Beyond, published by Triumph. Thank you so much for being with us.
Leonard, it has been an absolute ball. I appreciate all the questions, and it's been a lot of fun with you.